offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series. This is Prem, your friend from Team Redu Sai, and it's my pleasure to join you live from our studios at the Sri Satya Sai Media Center. After a gap of a couple of weeks, we are resuming our live broadcast, thanks to Swami. I hope all of you are keeping well and safe. Everything is safe and fine here. We had a break in the ninth chapter that we are going through. As I said, I couldn't do the live program for the past couple of weeks. We were in the last part of the ninth chapter. We have about five shlokas to complete. So we will be completing the ninth chapter in probably the next week. Before we continue with what we have for this week, let me give you a brief summary of what we covered last time, because it's all in the flow, it's all in the context. So just to refresh ourselves, we covered three verses the last time around, verse number 27, 28, and 29. In this section, or these three shlokas, we could say are an elaboration of the 26th verse, where Krishna says that my devotees, if they offer a leaf, a flower, a fruit, and water with a pure heart, that is more than enough, I accept it. So that's the context for the three shlokas that we went through last time. In the 27th verse, which we had discussed, Krishna says, Yat karoshi, whatever you do, yat ashnasi, whatever you eat, yat juhoshi, whatever you offer in worship, dadasi yat, whatever you give, yat tapasyasi, whatever you practice as austerity, kaunteya tat kurushva madarpanam. O Arjuna, that itself do as an offering unto me. A beautiful shloka where Krishna says how every act can become one of worship, and everything that one gives or offers can become an offering unto God. Krishna states you don't have to do anything out of the ordinary in the name of puja, in the name of upasana. Just make whatever you do an act of worship. That is what is beautifully conveyed in that shloka. In the 28th shloka, Krishna reminds us what happens when one is able to lead a life like this, where everything one does, everything one gives is made as an offering. He says, this will slowly release you from karma bandhana, or the bondage of karma. And how does that happen? You become neutral to shubha ashubha phalau, to good and bad results of the actions that are performed. And when you become neutral to the consequences, the mind becomes steadfast in yoga through such renunciation. Sannyasa yoga yuktatma. That's what one becomes. One's mind is driven by this renunciation, and one is able to remain steadfast in the path. Having been freed this way, Krishna asserts, Mam upashyasi. To me, they shall come. In the 29th verse, Krishna addresses a doubt that may occur whenever Krishna is saying all this. Whatever you do it for me. Whatever you offer, do it as an offering to me. One may wonder that, is Krishna saying that if you do everything for me, then I will give you freedom, I will let you free. Otherwise, I curse you to be bound to the world. Is that the tone that Krishna is trying to convey? Is it a sign of Krishna's partiality? As we saw, what is the difference between someone who favors those who praise him or her and what Krishna is trying to convey here? Krishna clarifies that by saying, I am the same towards all beings. To me, there is none that is hateful or dear, but those who worship me with devotion are in me, and I am also in them. That is the 29th verse where Krishna clarifies that. And we saw how Krishna is stating the truth. If life is led this way, the freedom is guaranteed. This is not something that Krishna is saying, I will do this for you if you do this for me. Right? That is a understanding that two individuals come to. But here what Krishna is stating is the truth. If life is led in a certain manner, this will be the reward for that. This is the guaranteed freedom. Swami gives the example of fire. If you are close enough, whoever you are, doesn't matter which caste or category or gender you come from, whoever you are, if you're close enough to the fire, you will benefit from the warmth. Staying away from the fire, if you feel cold and you can't blame fire for being partial, the fire is being partial, it is giving warmth only to the people who come towards it. But that is the nature of fire, right? So what Swami is stating here is the nature of life. This is not about an individual striking a deal with another. Swami in fact says in the Gita Vahini that we just cannot attribute any slightest amount of partiality or favoritism to God, because if there is any semblance of peace left in this world, it is because God is fair and just. Probably that one statement can be spoken about and elaborated for an entire hour. It's a very, very profound statement. If there is any semblance of peace left in this world, it is because God is fair and just. And if you really look at it, we think of it the exact opposite way. We think whenever we find that there is injustice or something is unfair, we turn and blame God. In fact, it's the other way around. It is because God is fair, there is some sense of harmony and sensibility in this world. And it is this idea that God is not partial towards anyone. God is absolutely open to anyone who turns to Him, is something that is going to be spoken of in the next few shlokas. And a very strong contrast is given by Krishna to drive home this very important lesson. So as always, we'll listen to the next shloka in the voice of Brother Shyam, who has been so kind to render the shlokas so clearly and so beautifully for us. We'll listen to shloka number 30 of the 9th chapter. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail or unravel some of the subtle points that Krishna is making in this particular shloka.
Api chet suduracharo bhajate mamananya bhak sadhureva samantavyaha samyak vyavasito hi saha.
Even the most sinful, if he worships me with his whole heart, shall be considered righteous, for he has rightly resolved. So that's the 30th verse of the 9th chapter. As I was saying, a shloka that needs to be unraveled because it can be misunderstood quite easily. Especially if it is quoted separately and out of context, because till now Krishna was speaking about a devotee or how to be a true devotee. Do everything as an offering to God, then the mind develops detachment and so on. And the moment we say a great devotee of the Lord, we automatically picture someone who is pious, who is soft-natured, who is good in all his dealings or her dealings with others, right? But now Krishna is speaking of those individuals whom we picture in the other end of the spectrum, exactly opposite to what we would think of as a good devotee. He uses an interesting phrase to describe such individuals. He says, Sudurachara. Sudurachara. The word Sadacharaha means one who is well behaved or one who performs the right actions and refrains from doing wrong actions. Sat Achara. So it is good actions or actions performed by those who are good. So that is sadacharaha. The opposite of sadacharaha is duracharaha, one who performs bad actions or does not do what is expected of him or her. But here Krishna uses the word sudurachara, which means one who is perfectly bad, right? Not someone who does wrong actions now and then, but somebody who is bad all the time. Sudurachara, perfectly bad. We all have flaws, make mistakes once in a while. I'm sure, I mean, I can tell that about myself, and I'm sure most of you also will agree that we're all given to performing mistakes and making blunders every now and then. Especially when we are put under a stressful situation or under pressure. But Krishna is talking about, and he's not talking about an average individual who once in a while, when pushed against the corner, does a few mistakes. But he's talking about a sudurachara, one who is truly bad, who's perfectly bad at all times. Excuse me. So he's talking about a sudurachara. What does Krishna say about such a person? He says, api cheta, even if sudurachara, a very wicked person or a perfectly wicked person, bhajate mam, worships me, ananya bhak, with one-pointedness, sadureva sa mantavyaha, he should be considered to be a sadhu or a pious person. Samyak vyavastitaha hi saha, because he is a samyak vyavastitaha, one whose understanding is clear, or one who has resolved things clearly in the mind. So you can clearly see why the shloka can be misinterpreted. It is almost like Krishna is suggesting, as long as you are my devotee, you are a noble person. Even if you are otherwise a sudurachara, a perfectly bad person, all that you need to do is become a devotee of Swami. Then you are whitewashed, right? Whatever you do, whatever your blunders you make, it doesn't matter. As long as you go to the temple, as long as you bow to Krishna. That seems to be a very easily misinterpretable shloka, right? And that seems to be a recipe for what probably we could call religious disaster. If anyone quotes this shloka and tries to misinterpret it to you, you can tell them, please go and read the rest of the Gita. Then you will understand that the entire Gita is about dharma or right action, and not merely what appears to be the right action, but what is truly the right action. So Gita being a dharma shastra, in no way it will give us license to do misdeeds, especially in the name of devotion. Right? Then why is Krishna saying this? Let us ask ourselves, have we really seen a person whom we can refer to as a sudurachara, a person who is perfectly bad or consistently bad with all her or his actions? When Krishna asks Yudhishthira and Duryodhana in the Mahabharata, I'm sure most of you would be aware of this episode. Swami has spoken about it. It has been dramatized by Swami's students, where he calls Yudhishthira and Duryodhana to find a perfectly bad person and a perfectly good person. Yudhishthira is sent to find a perfectly bad person, and Duryodhana is sent to find a perfectly good person. Yudhishthira comes back and says, if there is any person who can be referred to as a bad person, it is only me. What is the significance of that? And why does Swami praise that attitude of Yudhishthira? In that episode, there is actually a definition of what is a good person and our misunderstanding of how we define a bad person. I don't think Yudhishthira did not see bad qualities at all. Because he's a king, he's going to be ruling the kingdom. He certainly has discrimination. He can say good from bad. He can say what is wrong and what is right. But then why did Yudhishthira come back and say that I did not see a bad person at all. That is because a truly noble person will not define anyone's character by seeing the flaws in them. They will see the flaws, but they will see them as flaws and will not label the person as being a bad person. But on the contrary, what we all tend to do is this. Based on a very few or far narrow random interactions we have with individuals, we label them as being bad, selfish, just because of that one episode we would have interacted or seen them. I'm saying this because I have observed myself doing this so often. I would have had one random interaction with a person, or I would have merely been an observer in an incident involving that person. Say I would have seen that person breaking a line or shouting at someone. Even years later, when I see that person, the mind will think, oh, he's that fellow who shouted like that the other day, or he's that person who was selfish like this. That's how we all tend to judge people, isn't it? And it is almost impossible to certify anyone as a sudurachara. For how can we observe every act of any individual for that matter? And even if we do, how can we know the thoughts that inspired those actions? So when Krishna says a perfectly bad person, it represents two things as I understand. It stands for those whom we label as being a sudurachara, a bad person, just because we have observed a few of their wrong deeds. A sort of connection to that we will see even in the next shloka. The second understanding is our judgment of our own selves. Yudhishthira not only felt there were no bad people, but he was quite self-critical too, isn't it? He declared that I am the worst person. If there is any bad person in the world, it should be me. In him, it represented a noble quality because of his nature of adhering to dharma. But in many of us, that becomes a very bad quality and obstacle in the path of spirituality itself, because we end up defining ourselves based on a few acts, misdeeds that we have done, and conclude that I am a sinner, I have no redemption, I don't deserve to live, I don't deserve Swami's love, and on, we don't stop at all. So I think this shloka refers to such judgment as well. Our judgment of others and our judgment of ourselves as being sudurachara. And then it speaks of the power of devotion. And not just any form of devotion, of just worshipping or doing some yajnas or doing some pujas. As we have seen, doing puja for some benefit is not true upasana. That is only an extension of karma. But with a little bit of humility, whenever we offer prayers as part of our efforts, it kind of inculcates a little bit of humility in us. That's why Krishna says it is not any kind of worship, it is samyak vyavasthitaha, one who is, whose understanding is clear now, who is resolved clearly what is devotion and what is worship, one who begins to do everything as an offering to God, as Krishna mentioned in the previous shloka and a few shlokas before that. Such clarity comes when the person, Krishna says, bhajate mam ananya bhak, worships me with one-pointedness. And this is what we have discussed as ananya bhakti, one-pointedness. Such a person, when we look at him, yes, there is a possibility that he or she may be doing wrong acts, or what they may appear to be wrong, because we are observing them from a certain point of view. Just for example, imagine the Mahabharata war itself. The war is happening right now. By some strange turn of events, you don't know who is who of Mahabharata. You just end up in the middle of the battlefield. You don't know who are the Pandavas. You don't know who are the Kauravas. You don't know what is happening between them. And you see this Arjuna, who's a great warrior, who seems to be a young and dashing warrior, and he is firing arrow after arrow on this old man, Bhishma. right? And he's doing it with such ferocity, and imagine what will be your opinion of Arjuna. Certainly you will conclude at that moment that, oh my God, this is such a cruel and arrogant prince. And if someone comes and tells you he's shooting arrows at his grandfather who brought him up, that's it. Your opinion about Arjuna will become even worse. And in fact, that was Arjuna's fear too. What will people think of me? That if I decimate all these people and then I rule, what will the world think of me? And the essence of Krishna's discourse is addressing that. There is one basic discrimination between good and bad, right and wrong. You follow that. But there is a nobility that is deeper than good and bad actions. And for that, the mind has to be purified further, and certain things have to be resolved in the mind. When we have done that, there is still a chance that you might appear wrong to the world. So Krishna says, even if such a person appears to be evil in the eyes of the world, sadhureva samantavyaha, he should be considered a sadhu. Whether or not anyone considers you a sadhu, the Lord will consider you a sadhu. I think that is the unsaid part of that shloka. And when the Lord considers you as a sadhu, his promise, paritranaya sadhu nam sambhavami yuge yuge. Swami would say, not just yuge yuge, pade pade, every step. The moment the Lord considers you as a sadhu, he will do whatever it takes to protect you. However good or noble we are, there is always a chance that we will be misjudged. So the sooner we move on from the need for validation from others and also develop this dependence on the validation from Swami alone, I think that is going to be our escape velocity. In the Gita Vahini, Swami says, God is not like others who go by the externals. He is only interested in what's inside. God knows and reacts to the inner feelings, not to the appearance. In that sense, we can say that the right resolution that we are talking about is also this. When I have this ananya bhakti, I will not be bothered about how I am perceived by others. I might be seen as a sudurachara by others, but the goal should be to be seen as sadhu in God's view. So the summary is, once this right form of devotion takes root in the heart, a person may appear bad, may even be doing wrong acts by force of habit from the past, but the person should be considered as being noble because now the resolution in the mind is right. I'm going to some place, I'm traveling in a car or I'm going to a certain destination. Let's say I've lost my way. But the moment I've realized that I've lost my way and I've figured out the right route, even though I might be on the wrong road, I am still in the right direction because now I have resolved the confusion and I am in the process of rerouting myself and moving in the right direction. So for the world, it might look like, oh, you're going to this place, you're in the wrong place. You're in the wrong road, you're in the wrong route. But because I've resolved the confusion and I am getting myself back to the right route, I am on the right route. And Krishna further elaborates that in the next one. So we will listen to that shloka and we will take this discussion forward. That is the 31st shloka. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning of that and then we'll discuss.
Kshipram bhavati dharmatma shashvachantin nigachati kaunteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashyati.
He soon becomes possessed of a virtuous mind. He attains everlasting peace. Do proclaim boldly, O son of Kunti, that my devotee does not get ruined. So that's the 31st verse of the 9th chapter. As I was saying, there's a possibility that even after turning to God, the way Krishna has been describing, there are a few vasanas that may remain. Some habits don't go easily. In Swami's discourses, he would say, this very moment you must give up bad habits and wrong ways. I'm not saying that it is not possible or don't take Swami's words seriously. That's not what I'm trying to tell. The resolution to give up wrong ways must be taken right away. Once we realize it is wrong, the resolution should be taken then and there. But in action, some of these habits, some of these wrong ways, it may take a little time for us to give up completely. Swami would tell us when we were students, slow and permanent change is always better than quick and temporary change. The transformation that happens slowly is invariably more permanent. But sometimes in our emotional excitement, there is a swift change in everything that we do. And then after a period of time, it fizzles out. I think we should not get discouraged by that, or, you know, there was so much change in me when I first came to Swami. Oh God, I've reverted back to my old self, and oh, I'm a horrible person. I think we don't need to give ourselves to such despondency, because there is a possibility that these durachara nature that is in us may remain in us for a little time. As Swami would say, it is like switching off the ceiling fan. Even after this fan has been switched off, it will rotate for a brief time, isn't it? So the flaws in the mind, the vasanas, old habits are also like that. But what Krishna says here is, kshipram, very soon, bhavati dharmatma, the person becomes righteous. Kshipram, very soon. And he uses the word dharmatma. Dharmatma is one who is an embodiment of dharma. We could say it is the perfect antonym for sudurachara. One who is perfectly wrong. The opposite of that is dharmatma, one who is perfectly righteous. He or she is not good only when conditions are conducive for goodness. A dharmatma is always good and righteous, whatever be the conditions or the circumstance. So if we were to put together what Krishna is saying in the past few shlokas, which is important because we will lose the context otherwise, Krishna says, a person who has such ananya bhakti, who does all actions as an offering to please God, gets detached from good and bad results and thereby releases himself from karma itself. He becomes a sannyasi in the mind, or in other words, he develops true vairagya, and then he becomes a dharmatma. So this is the whole process that Krishna is speaking about. And once the person becomes a dharmatma, shashvat shantim nigachati, he attains eternal peace. Whether we agree or not, there is a certain amount of peace that comes with doing the right thing. And we all have experienced it in our own ways. When you take a moral stand, when you have been selfless, when you have taken a decision that is right, knowing well it is going to harm your interests in some ways, there is a certain peace that you feel from inside, isn't it? That is nothing but the shanti that is experienced every time we align ourselves to the conscience within. But our problem is that we go out of alignment every now and then. Every time there is a situation that challenges us, there is always a chance of us going out of alignment, or sometimes we are forcefully wanting to do something that is right, and that also leads to a little bit of loss of peace. But when this devotee becomes a dharmatma, an embodiment of peace, shashvat shantim nigachati, the shanti that is attained and experienced is shashvat or eternal. And the next line of that shloka is very powerful, a beautiful, profound statement made by Krishna. He says, Kaunteya, O Arjuna, pratijanihi, proclaim for certain or proclaim with confidence, मे भक्तः मई भक्ता न प्रणश्यति डस नॉट पेरिश. कृष्णा इज टेलिंग अर्जुना यू विल नॉट बी रॉन्ग इफ यू डिक्लेयर टू द वर्ल्ड माई डिवोटीज डू नॉट पेरिश. Another remarkable declaration and assurance from Krishna in this chapter. Krishna had said, whoever is devoted to me, I will take care of their yoga and kshema. Here he says, name bhaktah pranashyati. My devotees do not perish. Period. As Swami would say very beautifully in his discourses, nammaka chedina varu unnaru kani, నమ్మి చెడిన వారు లేరు లేరు లేరు. స్వామి వుడ్ సో ఎంఫాటిక్లీ మేక్ దట్ డిక్లరేషన్. నమ్మక చెడిన వారు ఉన్నారు కానీ దెర్ మే బీ దోస్ హూ లాస్ట్ దేర్ వే అండ్ పెరిష్డ్ బికాస్ దే ల్యాక్డ్ ఫెయిత్. దే డిడ్ నాట్ హ్యావ్ ద రిక్వెసిట్ ఫెయిత్ అండ్ సో దే పెరిష్డ్. కానీ బట్ నమ్మి చెడిన వారు లేరు లేరు లేరు. But there can be no case whatsoever of those who had perished having faith. And this is the experience of so many devotees, isn't it? Sometime back I was listening to an experience that was shared by one of our seniors, a very senior alumnus who is also a Sevadal member. And he had this opportunity to be a Sevadal member in Swami's Thrai Brindavan, right? The compound around Swami's Mandir in the Brindavan Ashram. There were these devotees, there were these Sevadal who had duty there. When Swami is in Brindavan, they would be there for the entire day, and they had many beautiful interactions with Swami. So this brother of ours was narrating that one day, when the devotees were all standing and waiting for Swami's darshan, there were a few lady devotees in the compound, and Swami was just coming down from his room in Thrai Brindavan. And just then, if you ever had the good fortune of being in that Thrai compound, you'll know that the entire compound has many, many, many coconut trees. I think nothing less than 40 or 50 coconut trees filled with, you know, the whole area around has so many such coconut trees. So the devotees were standing probably under one of those trees, and a branch which had completely got dried up suddenly fell from that tree, and it just fell a few feet away from where these devotees were standing. And you can imagine all those devotees shrieked and pretty audibly. And Swami was just coming out at that time, and Swami looked at it and Swami got very upset. So Swami called this brother, and Swami said, what is this? What would have happened if it had fallen on, the devotees? So Swami instructs this Sevadal. He said, you go and get these people who can climb trees and remove all of these dried leaves. And Swami said, see, there are so many trees around. You get one person, let him get this work done. Let all these dried branches and leaves be removed from the coconut trees. So Swami says this. Swami goes for darshan, and then Swami retires. Sometime around 10:30, 11, that was the time. Once Swami retires, some of these people would take it easy because Swami would not come back till later in the afternoon. So this brother of ours, he also had a shop which was very close to Swami's ashram. So he was going back to his shop. On the way, he was trying to find out if there's anybody who would come and do this. Surprisingly, whomever he met who was into this kind of work, almost everyone refused to come and do this work. Because apparently what had happened was, I think some devotee who has employed their services to get such work done has not paid them properly. So everyone whom he was meeting and asking, can you come and do this? He said, oh, Sai Baba Ashram, we are not coming. They don't pay us properly. And he was wondering why everybody is saying like this. I mean, that's not the case usually. But somehow that day, the two, three people that he approached, none of them wanted to come and do this work. So finally, it so happens that he goes, he opens his shop, he's sitting there. There was one vendor who used to come and sell him tender coconuts every day. So kind of an arrangement. Whenever he opens the shop, that person would come and give a tender coconut. So he looked at him and said, hey, are you free today? Can you do this? I want someone who can climb a coconut tree and remove all the dried leaves. And he said, yes, sir, I can do that. I do that also. I pluck the coconuts. I can do that also. So he says, okay, can you come with me? We'll go to Swami's ashram. This has to be done. And immediately that person also said, sir, if you want for your house, you call me. I will come and do. Don't call me to Swami's ashram. Sai Baba ashram, we will not come. So he asked, what happened? Why are you saying this? And then again, he said this. The last time somebody called me like this, and you know, they promised to pay this much, they didn't pay that much. So he said, I've had enough, I'm not coming. So then this person said, do you trust me? I mean, you're ready to come and do it at my house. Do you trust me? He said, yes, for you I will do, but not in Sai Baba ashram. So this man tells him, okay, you come and you do it in Swami's ashram, but I will pay you. Since you trust me, I will pay you. So then this man says, but I have these 10 coconuts that I have to sell. So he says, okay, how many do you have? I have 10, 20 of them. So he says, okay, I will buy all of them and then I'll pay you for this work also. You come. Because this Sevadal was very keen that this work should be done before Swami comes back for the afternoon darshan. So takes this man and he goes and this person starts climbing the coconut trees and removing these dried branches. And as he was doing this to one of the trees, which is just next to Swami's window, this brother of ours noticed that Swami's window opened and Swami was observing from there. And briefly after that, what happened is Swami came down, opened the three doors and Swami came out. Right? And this man is plucking these dried leaves. So the moment Swami came, this Sevadal brother also came running. And then Swami started telling, why is he climbing the tree like this? This is not safe. You should. And then Swami was telling how in some places in Karnataka, how they climb the tree and that is a better way of climbing the tree. And Swami told the Sevadal person, you tell him that this is how it should be done. So this brother of ours, he thought, why not call that man himself, and Swami could speak to him. It would be an opportunity for him to have a word with Swami. So he turns up and calls that man. He says, come here. And Swami is standing next to him. This man comes running and then Swami tells him, you know, this is not how you should climb. You should have a rope and you should do it this way. So this man was nodding his head. And then Swami began talking to him and asked him, where are you from? He named a village which was nearby. And as Swami was speaking so lovingly and kindly to him, this man started feeling extremely guilty. He said, oh God, I spoke so ill of Swami. Is he going to pull me up for that? And then Swami started speaking to him. And then Swami asked him, how many are you married? He said, yes, Swami. How many children do you have? He said, Swami, I have 7 daughters. And Swami said, my God, 7 daughters. And then Swami waved his hand, materialized vibhuti and gave it to him. And now this man was trembling with emotions. He said, Swami, I spoke ill of you, Swami. He said, no, nothing like that. Take this. Swami gave him vibhuti. And then Swami turned around. There was nobody to offer a handkerchief to Swami to wipe his hand. So very lovingly, Swami, you know, wiped his hand on that man's head. Must have been perspiring and sweaty. But in spite of that, Swami very lovingly patted him. And this man was reduced to a pulp. He was crying and crying and he said, Swami, I'm really sorry I spoke so ill about you before coming here. Swami said, nothing like that. You finish your work and you go. And then Swami calls the Sevadal person, takes him inside Thrai Brindavan, and Swami tells him, I want to give something to this man. And then Swami goes inside and brings a bundle of money. And Swami starts counting. And then Swami looks at the Sevadal and Swami says, he said 7 daughters. 1,000 rupees per child, is it enough? Shall we give him 7,000 rupees? And imagine this, we are talking about something like 15, 20 years ago. It's not a small amount of money to give someone. And Swami is saying, of course, Swami, that's nothing. I'm just saying in a general sense. So Swami asks him, and this man, this Sevadal says, Swami, whatever you give is prasadam, whatever you choose to give. So Swami counts and Swami takes 7,000 rupees and Swami gives it to him and says, you go and give it to him. And then this brother of ours says, Swami, it would be very nice if you can give it to him personally. He'll feel very happy. Swami says, okay, I will give it to him. And then Swami again comes out of Thrai. Swami calls this man. And then Swami hands over this money. Imagine for the work that he was doing. Swami gives him 7,000 rupees. And this man is again sobbing uncontrollably, saying, Swami, I'm really sorry. And this is so much grace. I cannot handle it. And Swami said, no, you take this. And Swami told, I'm giving 1,000 rupees for each of your daughters. Get them good clothes. I'm not paying you. This is for Ugadi. Ugadi is coming, so I want to give this as my prasadam to them. This man was so grateful for that. And then Swami again goes back and says, Tarai Brindavan. This man by then finishes all the work of removing all these dried branches. And just when they're leaving, again Swami comes to the window and Swami calls out to the Sevadal. And Swami gives a huge basket of fruits. And Swami says, give it to that man, ask him to take it home for his children. Right? For that simple work of pulling down dried leaves from the coconut tree. So this man is so happy. So this is one episode that happens 15 years later. After this episode, this Sevadal brother of ours was standing at a bus stand or something like that. And next to him was standing another gentleman whom he did not know. And suddenly that person turns to him and says, sir, do you recognize me? And he looks at him and he says, no, sir, I have not met you before. And then he says, sir, I am the person whom you have taken to Baba's ashram for removing the dried leaves from the coconut trees. And he looks at this man. He is wearing a silk dhoti and a silk kurta and seems to be like some, landlord. And he says, what happened to you? You know, you seem to have transformed a lot. And then that man says, sir, what do I tell you? After I came and did that small work in Swami's ashram, my fortunes completely turned. I had a piece of waste land somewhere in the outskirts of Bangalore, where now ITPL stands, I guess. And he says, that was the only thing I had. I sold it and it fetched me few crores. Now I have built a two-storied house for each one of my 7 daughters. Every one of them are well settled and I have no need left in my life. That is the amount of blessing that can come if even the smallest service is offered to Swami, right? And the beautiful thing was, that day, one point I missed out is when Swami was giving him that 7,000 rupees for his daughters, Swami looks at this Sevadal and Swami says, see, this is not payment for the services that he is rendering. What you have promised to pay him, you should pay that. This is my prasadam, right? So whatever little is offered to God, what comes from Him in the form of prasadam is enough to fill not only our needs, but the needs of generations of our families to come. And that is for a physical act offered and a physical blessing received. Can one even imagine, as Swami says, one who is having ananya bhakti to me, the one who comes and offers something like this, can draw from Swami such immense grace. One can just imagine if one has ananya bhakti, right? And such physical manifestation of Swami's grace is only to drive that point. Physical well-being, physical and monetary well-being is the least of Swami's grace that He can shower on us. For one who has dedicated one's entire life to Swami like this, you can be sure there is no downfall. Name bhakta pranashyati. However it may appear to you and me, but this is the proclamation that Swami is giving. Name bhakta pranashyati. My devotee will never perish. Right? A very beautiful, profound statement from Swami. So that is the 31st verse. We'll go to the next verse also. We'll listen to it. It is also in the same explanation that he is giving. But again, a shloka that needs to be unraveled a little bit because it can lead to a lot of misunderstanding.
Maam hi parthavya paashritya ye pisyuh papayonayaha striyo vaishyastatha shudraha te piyanti parangatim.
By taking refuge in me, even men of evil birth, women, vaishyas and also shudras attain the supreme state. So that's the 32nd verse of the 9th chapter. As I was saying, there is also a shloka that can be easily misunderstood. This shloka should be first of all seen in the context of the times and an extension of the theme, that is the glory of one-pointed devotion to God. If you look at our own journey, our own spiritual path, whatever we have taken, we have many obstacles on this path. And if you really observe deeply, they are nothing but the makings of our own mind. We tend to say, oh, my parents are not devotees of Swami. Oh, my husband or wife doesn't allow me to do sadhana. They are not a devotee. Or I cannot chant Rudram because I have not learnt Sanskrit. Oh, I'm missing out on something. I'm not inclined to reading. If I read a little, I fall asleep. How do I read Swami's Vahinis? How do I read Swami's the other spiritual texts? Truly speaking, none of these things are mandatory for spiritual progress. Yes, they all are helpful in their own way, but certainly none of them are mandatory or essential. Now, from time to time, the society or the community that we are part of, or those in influence, tend to put certain restrictions on certain groups of people, say to practice some sadhanas or in the entry into some religious places and so on. So like that, there were people who placed restrictions on women to learn or chant the Vedas, or people belonging to a certain caste were not allowed into temples. A guru will not take you as a disciple if you belong to a certain community. This will periodically happen for various reasons in the societies that we live in. I'm either justifying them or going to try and explain them. Let us just say that this is the reality of life. This is what power does. This is what misconceptions and dogmas always do in society. There will be some unfair treatment towards some sections of society. And when such restrictions are placed, and if we happen to belong to any of these groups that are denied such opportunities, it is quite natural for us to think that we are so unfortunate because a means to reach God has been taken away from us. But in reality, this is not true at all. Because God is not far. God is within us. Whatever be my gender, whatever be my birth, my class, my religion, my caste, etc., etc., God is still within me. In fact, I and God are not separate, but you know, here, since we are talking of such means that enables us to reach God, we will talk in terms of Dvaita. And even then, God is within, isn't it? And hence, there is no distance that needs to be traveled. No particular act needs to be done. Whatever we are doing in the name of sadhana is to recognize the God within. And that is why Krishna said in that previous shloka, there is nothing. Whatever you do, do it as an offering to me. Whomever you serve, you do it as a service that you're doing to me. Whomever you show love to, remember that love, you're showing it to me. So whatever we are doing in the name of sadhana is to recognize this God within ourselves and within each one. And this is, as we have seen in this section of the Gita, best experienced through devotion. So when we develop ananya bhakti, there is nothing to seek. Everything one sees is the Lord. So in that sense, all mental obstacles, even the noble ones of what is good company, what is a holy place, what is a holy act, all such mental conceptions are also removed. So all these restrictions are created in our own mind and are destroyed also in our own mind, even though it may have a trigger in society or something that is being done outside. So in this shloka, Krishna mentions a few such. So when we listen to this shloka, it is not that any of these people mentioned are less in any way. Krishna is only addressing the mental obstacles that is in our own minds. He says, హి పార్థ, ఇండీడ్ ఓ అర్జున, మాం వ్యపాశ్రిత్యయే, వన్ హూ టేక్స్ రెఫ్యూజ్ ఇన్ మీ, అపిస్యుహు ఈవన్ మే బీ పాపయోనయ, ఎ సిన్ఫుల్ పర్సన్, ఎ పర్సన్ ఆఫ్ సిన్ఫుల్ బర్త్, స్త్రియః, విమెన్, వైశ్యాః, వైశ్యాస్, తథా ఆల్సో శూద్రాః, శూద్రాస్. Now you can see why I gave that lengthy clarification. Krishna is saying, you may be of sinful birth, you may be a woman or a Vaishya or a Shudra, the two lowest castes in the society as it is understood. Krishna is not putting down any caste, or he is not putting down woman by saying that even a woman can attain this. That's not the idea. Each of these categories that Krishna is mentioning represents a mental obstacle that we have created due to, of course, the prevalent practices in society. That's why this shloka also has to be seen as addressing the time period, right? Because we are talking of a time period when women were not allowed to chant the Gayatri or learn the Vedas due to some misconceptions. So because of which, suppose I am a woman in that society, I might think that, oh God, I cannot redeem myself because I cannot learn these Vedas and I cannot chant the mantras. So Swami Krishna is addressing that mental obstacle that we have. So Krishna says, whoever takes refuge in me, O Arjuna, be it a one of sinful birth, a woman, a Shudra, a Vaishya, yanti param gatim, will attain the supreme goal. As I was telling a few weeks back, this whole section of the Gita and few others like this we had come across, the main idea that is being conveyed is, for the spiritual journey, you don't need anything. You don't need to be born in a particular family. You don't need to be born in a particular country. You don't have to have riches. You don't even have to give up riches. Spirituality is all about a change in the way we approach life. That's why Krishna also says there is no partiality here. Whoever turns to him benefits. There is no precondition whatsoever. So whatever Krishna is mentioning in this shloka, the words that he used about the Shudras, the Vaishyas, he says the Papa Yonyaha, somebody who thinks that I've born to a wrong family, it's a sinful family that I'm born in, or I don't have elders who can guide me in the right way. These are all mental blocks. Yes, if you have good company, that helps. Yes, if you have parents who are noble, that helps. Yes, if you're born into a community where there are no restrictions, or you're born into a free society where no kinds of restrictions are placed on you, that is an advantage. But none of these can completely deny you the opportunity of reaching the ultimate state. So this shloka should be, as I said, seen as Krishna addressing the mental blocks in our mind. It is not Krishna re-emphasizing or giving credence to some of these prevalent practices in society. That's why Swami repeatedly says there is no partiality here. Krishna is not saying that I'm available only to this community, I'm available only to this set of people. There is no partiality. And that's why Swami writes in this very beautiful passage in the Gita Vahini. I'd like to just read out that portion. Swami writes, he says, if the Lord himself was affected by partiality, how could he award the bliss of spiritual union to the cowherd maids of Vrindavan? Would he have partaken of fruits partly eaten by Shabari? Could Janaka have become a knower of Brahman? Could Nandanar have achieved the grand vision of the Lord? Could Prahallada and Vibhishana have approached the Lord? Would Hanuman have been accepted as the messenger of Rama? Could Valmiki have written the great epic, the Ramayana? Do these indicate any partiality in the composition of the Lord? Or do they prove that he has no such trait whatsoever? These are examples of the Lord's love, His uniform kindness to all. End of quote. The Bhagavatam and the stories of great modern saints are filled with such examples, isn't it? Look at all the beautiful examples that Swami is giving here. The Gopikas, uneducated women, not initiated into any spiritual practice that we know of. But did they not reach the spiritual union with Krishna? In fact, they are held as examples. Then Swami mentions Shabari, again an uneducated woman who was supposed to be from a backward tribe actually. Then Swami talks of Janaka, a king, an example Krishna gives multiple times to Arjuna to remind him that you don't have to become a sannyasi to become spiritual. You can remain a king, you can dispense your duties. Didn't a king become Brahmajnani, Swami says. Then Swami mentions Nandanar. Again, a beautiful one of the Nayanmars mentioned in the Peripuranam. A great devotee born in a lower class, in a lower caste, who used to work with leather. You know, he used to work in the fields as a laborer and make leather with which skins were made for drums. And he was born in a time when Dalits were not allowed inside temples. So being a great devotee of Lord Shiva, he would go to these temples and he would stand in the entrance and he would sing and dance in devotion to Lord. He once visits a Shiva temple in this town called Tiruppunkur. And as he usually does, he stands outside and prays to Lord Shiva. But one of the features of the temple is a huge nandi that is placed right in front of the sanctum. Like in most temples, the nandi is always in front of the sanctum, right? But in this temple, the nandi was so huge. It was, I think, more than 6-7 feet tall. And it was completely blocking the doorway of that sanctum sanctorum. And because he was not allowed inside the temple, he was standing outside and he just could not have darshan of the Lord. In devotional agony, Nandanar cries out to Lord Shiva. And the story goes that Lord Shiva orders Nandi to move out so that this devotee can have his darshan. So the whole Nandi idol moves to the side so that Nandanar could have darshan of Lord Shiva. And even today, if you go to that temple in Tiruppunkur, you will find that the Nandi is not in alignment with the Linga like elsewhere. Then Swami mentions Prahallada and Vibhishana. They belong to the Rakshasa clan. Then he says Hanuman. Hanuman is a monkey, not even a human birth. Then he says Valmiki, a highway robber and a murderer. Perfectly fits that term Sudurachara, isn't it? Even he could earn the grace of the Lord. So this is the essence of this entire section, the power of Ananya Bhakti, one-pointed devotion to God. If by some stroke of luck, we find ourselves having some devotion to Swami in our heart, it may have come by any way. Maybe we inherited that devotion from our parents, or maybe it was inspired by a friend, maybe it was inspired by a teacher, or somehow you yourself picked up a book and you read about Swami and you developed this devotion. By whatever stroke of luck it has come to us, protect it, foster it. Nothing more is required to cross this ocean of Maya. I think that is the essence of what Krishna is saying in these different shlokas. So I think we'll conclude with that, dear listeners. We still have 2 more shlokas before we complete the 9th chapter. We'll do that next week. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I thank you all for your very patient listening. Till I meet you all next week for the resumption of this Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. Take care. Keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.